Welcome, listeners and Patreon subscribers, to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg. Every fortnight, I'm joined by Mr. Dave Ellis. Hello, Dave.
Hello, from a rainy, wet, weird Sydney. Very, very strange. 32 one day and 19 the next. How are you?
Like Melbourne. Yeah, I'm all right. It's been a busy week, but good. You get that. Yep. You get that on the big jobs.
You certainly do.
Anyway, so we have much to get through today on this week's show, so we shall jump forward into some follow-up. Now, Dave, you had a piece of follow-up here about John Petrucci and the next Dream Theater record. What do you got?
Yes. Look, there's been so much speculation for ages about John using an 8-string on the next album. You know, he's been teasing it for a while, and people have been going, oh, what's going on? Well, finally, in the last couple of weeks it's been since you and I got together to record, he has actually confirmed it, and he's actually said that there's going to be at the very least a prototype that he's going to use on the next Dream Theater album. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what he does.
Interesting to see if it actually makes it onto the record, because he's been saying this shit for years.
This is true.
He said it on the last one. He said it on the previous one. You know, oh, yeah, 8-string. And it's like, yeah, I'll believe it when it happens.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. But that being said, I mean, John's a reasonably honest guy. So, you know,
It's one of those things that's like, oh, yeah, I've got the 8-string. You bring it into the studio, you try it out, and you go, nah, it doesn't work.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, apparently
it's like John Myung and the Chapman stick. That makes an appearance in the studio on at least every record, and they never seem to use it all that often.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing that's really interesting, because with an 8-string, because obviously you've got much lower output, like you've got a lower note, right? So you have to have a higher output amplifier setting or pickup. So it's going to fundamentally change the sound of his pickups as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see what DiMarzio come up with. It's going to be interesting to see what Sterling and the guys at Ernie Ball come up with, and how it changes his actual tone. I just think it's going to be really, really interesting to sort of see what happens with it personally.
See, I think it'll come to the point where it might get used on like one song and it'll be like, this is too much of a change of a tone for me. Because we all know during there aren't that much for change on the tone. It's basically the same all the way through.
So
I can see it maybe coming in and making an appearance on a couple of songs, or maybe like a piece of something, and then it's about it.
Yeah.
Or maybe it'll just turn up on his solo records and he'll just stick with the 7s and the 6s for Dream Theater.
Yeah, maybe. Or, you know, he might end up writing the next Doom soundtrack. Who knows? Fingers crossed.
Yeah, who knows?
now, Hoggy, for those of the listeners who have heard the most recent show prior to this one with Mike and Salty, there's a couple of podcasts that you forgot to mention who I think we need to mention in here.
I'm not going to list all the true crime podcasts out there, although if you are looking for a good one, Red Handed is particularly good. Mm-hmm. The other two that I was going to mention are two music sort of discussion-related podcasts broadly similar to ours, but in different ways. The first one is Drop That Stylus.
Yep.
They cover an album every week. Mm-hmm. And then the second one is Radical Research, which is a whole like in-depth like investigative journalism into a particular sound or a particular. They've done an episode on Ulva, they did an episode on Stephen Wilson, they did one on Opeth. There's a whole several hundred episodes there, I think. So there's a couple. If you're interested in podcasting in a similar style to us, but with two different people, go and check those two out. They're pretty good.
Absolutely. And stay tuned as well, because we've got some stuff in the works at the moment with one of those podcasts. I'm not going to mention which one. So stay tuned, because we're going to reveal that hopefully reasonably soon.
So the last piece of follow-up that I had is Inside Out Music TV on their YouTube channel had put up a little YouTube video with Jim Gray and Ross Jennings. Jim Gray from Killing the Source, Ross Jennings from Haken. It was sort of billed as like an informal sort of Zoom chat between the two of them about what's happening with them and how their lives are going, and you know, the impact of this whole pandemic lockdown situation has been going on. It's a bit scratchy in parts, but you know, you get that with the YouTube channel with Zoom calls and stuff like that. It can be a bit patchy, but the general gist of the conversation is pretty good. And I'll throw a link in the show notes. People are going to have a listen to that. Basically, these two guys have been banging on about the same shit that we've been saying on this podcast for years. In that, it's affected them. Like, Ross Jennings has basically had to go out and take another job to, like, keep money floating into his household.
Jesus.
He's basically gone out and gone to take a he's gone to take a photography job to try and keep the good ship, you know, Ross Jennings and the good ship Haken afloat. So, and Jim obviously has his own sort of projects and jobs on the side to Caligula's horse. So they're able to kind of stay afloat in this sort of, in this situation, but they both sort of impacted the same thing that a lot of people have been saying, in that it's really affected the people in the crew because that is their sole source of income. That's the job that they do. And now they're all sitting at home wondering where in the world everything's going to come from.
Absolutely. And I mean, here in Australia, we had the federal budget announced last night and I didn't see anything in there for the arts. So
was there a great shock in that? Certainly wasn't really a great shock for me.
I mean, I also saw a news story very recently that water is wet. So,
yeah, exactly. You know. Night follows day, water's wet, details at 11. Exactly. That's basically the yeah. And the budget gives nothing for the arts. What a shocker.
Yeah, I know. But
just following on from that as well, the Marillion Couch Convention, they were raising money for their crew. And they were able to raise, the fans of Marillion raised something like 30-something on thousand pounds of money to split between the 9 or 10 members of the crew that Marillion have.
Yeah.
To try and help them pay bills and keep them afloat.
Exactly. And okay, I mean, that's £3,000 each. Like, it's nothing to be sniffed at.
Exactly. It only doesn't sound like a lot of money, but hey, it's better than a poke in the eye and a slap in the face.
Exactly. But yeah, look, I think that's about all there is for follow-up. I think it's time we jump into the news. Now, first cab off the rank, some really, really sad news that actually broke this morning at time of recording. One of arguably, probably not even arguably, I think consolidatedly, the greatest guitarists that have ever lived so far as revolutionizing the instrument is concerned, Eddie Van Halen, dead at 65.
Yeah, cancer. Fuck cancer, I tell you.
Yeah, throat cancer. I mean,
yeah, just...
Wow. I mean, because it felt like it was only a couple of months ago that I saw that he was touring and such. And, yeah, obviously it must have been longer than that because we all know how time compresses as you get older. But
totally. Or even how time compresses in this sort of COVID situation as well.
Yeah, that too, because every day just blends into one another.
There's been many, many posts from many influential guitar players. I saw a post from John Petrucci. There was a post from Gary Verkamp. There was a post from a whole bunch of different people have all expressed that, you know, that Eddie Van Halen was a big influence in their guitar playing. I mean, dear friend of the show, Doug Skeen, also posted something about Eddie Van Halen as well this morning. So
did Stephen Taranto.
Yeah. So, but you think about, like, many of the modern guitar players of today are probably influenced in some way by Eddie Van Halen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, basically, he's the father of tapping and gain and dive bombs. And, you know, he took all that stuff and did it all extremely well, even though there's a whole bunch of things out there that he stole his tapping and all that sort of stuff from someone else or some bullshit. I don't know. I don't care. He was the guy that revolutionized it. And it's just extremely sad because it's another one gone. Interestingly as well, today, Johnny Nash died as well.
Now I'm going to sound like a horrible bastard. Who's Johnny Nash?
I can see clearly now.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Okay. Big reggae and pop singer. He was also an actor and producer and, you know, as they all often are. But he died today as well, obviously overshadowed by the death of EVH. But you know, today was not a particularly kind day to the music world. So yeah, very, very sad and, rest in peace. And, you know, I do want to take this time to mention as well that obviously if his passing or Johnny's passing, has affected you, or if any of the things that we talk about in this show affect you in any way, there are always stacks of places to get help. And you can find those in the show notes below, but please reach out to someone, whether it be a friend or a family member, or even one of us. You can find us prowling many different forums and things like that. You can get in contact with us through the Dream Theater Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand or through the podcast or anything like that. Reach out and please get help.
Absolutely.
One of those ways that people often do get help is through, though, listening to, you know, great music and so on and so forth. And that's also been dealt another blow recently as with Anathema going on hiatus.
Well, going on a permanent hiatus, and the cause of this permanent hiatus is basically they can't afford to keep the band together anymore. I mean, they've all had to go off and take other jobs to try and keep themselves afloat in this situation. I mean, It's not nice to say, but I think Anathema was kind of floating on the fringes financially for quite some time anyway. Mm. I mean, no band willingly records a record every 2 years for a decade if they don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And this sort of links into a whole host of articles. There's probably one in your local area as well about how the arts are struggling. Many musicians have said they don't know how they're going to survive for the next 6 months.
Yep.
You know, we talked already about road crew people, you know, struggling financially. Never mind the mental struggles that we've just spoken about here before.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, there was an article in the British press saying something like 90% of musicians don't know how they're going to survive the next 6 months,
yeah,
money-wise, which is just bananas.
Yep, yep. There was another article in The Guardian from the UK as well that said that about a third of the entire industry will leave in the next little while.
It's already starting to happen.
Yep.
You know, I just spoke before about Ross Jennings, how he's having to take other work to keep himself afloat.
Yep.
Anathema have effectively, you know, they've gone on permanent hiatus. They've done this before, but in that time, they effectively broke the band up because they needed to, you know, make a living elsewhere. And there are many, many other artists who will either, you know, it was always like a side thing, so they've kind of had to put the side thing away to take care of their main job, or straight up abandon their hobbies and their craft to tend to try and keep themselves afloat financially.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. No, it's
what
really
can we as awful. People do about that? Well, at the risk of sounding like an old man, it's like, you know, write to your politicians and tell them how much this is affecting them.
Mm.
You know, try and lobby for more funding for the arts.
Mm.
We here in Australia have, you know, yelled long and hard about how much the federal government don't give a shit, but I guarantee it's happening in your country too, no matter where you are.
Particularly if you have a right-wing conservative government in. No offence if that's the way you vote, and I don't mean that to be a thing, but generally speaking, the right-wing conservative guys don't give a shit about the arts.
Well, they see the economy in purely in terms of like dollars in, dollars out. There was a quote from the Chancellor of the Exchequer today from the UK, how artists should just go and retrain and get other jobs.
Yeah.
Spoken like a true man who used to be an investment banker for Goldman Sachs. It's like, yes, of course, retraining and getting another job is an easy thing to do in this world. You know, you can totally retrain and go and get another job. You know, you just pack your art away, and, you know, and it led to many comments on the internet from people saying, you know, he should just stop watching television and don't go to the opera and don't listen to any music then if he thinks the arts are so unimportant, and then they can just go away and do another job. As if their job doesn't actually fucking matter at all.
Well, this is the thing that I always say to people who say things like that, you know, the arts aren't important. It's like, really? Okay, cool. So what are you going to do when you get home? Oh, I might watch some Netflix. Yeah, no, you're not. Don't watch Netflix. Don't watch television. Don't watch. You watch the news. That's fine. But don't watch anything else. Don't watch any form of entertainment. Don't listen to anything. Don't read anything.
Don't play video games.
Don't play video games. Don't do any of that. See how long you last. Someone I know did that recently. He and I had a bit of an argument about it, and you know, it was very much, oh, I said, just try it for a day, see how far you got. I think you got 20 minutes before you put the radio on.
There it is.
You know, it's like, mate, seriously, you can't. The arts are vitally important for numerous different reasons, and we've banged on long and hard on this show about that. So I'm not going to get into it here, but please. A, support your local artists and, you know, just do the right thing. Buy some merch from them, you know. If they put a digital show on for $10 a ticket or something, just buy a ticket, whether or not you bloody watch it or not. Or better yet, buy a ticket and have a few mates over, you know, and watch it together. Have a mosh pit in your bloody living room.
In addition to that as well, you know, if you're in a position where you're able to vote in the country that you live in, write to your local politician.
Mm.
Tell them you're not happy with how the artists are being treated.
Mm.
Write to your local politician, congressman, senator, MP, whatever they are in your part of the world. Mm. Write to them and tell them what you think about it.
Yep.
Because for all this sort of, you know, it's easy to sound off on social media or fire off a tweet. I guarantee you they get a whole lot less emails than they do social media stuff that's easier to scroll past and just, you know, work over the rising din of people on social media.
Absolutely.
If you actually get out and write them an email or write them a letter, you know, someone's going to have to read that.
Mm. Absolutely. And, you know, if you've got a particularly jobs-minded Parliament. You know, tell them this is supporting jobs, because it is. These people pay tax. They, you know, they support other industries as well. So
yeah, it's the secondary income that it generates for restaurants, hotels, pubs, clubs, all, yep. and all the people who work in those places. Yep. So
that's right.
Now, obviously, you know, certain parts of the world can't exactly have go back to having, you know, a couple hundred people in a room together. Hmm. That doesn't work. But there must be there seems to be a lot of things directed towards helping businesses. And unfortunately, artists, musicians, etc., entertainers, don't always fall under those categories, because there's like sole traders, or they're doing other sort of business arrangements that these regulations or these new ideas either, you know, straight up deliberately exclude, or number two, are just such an edge case that the government just doesn't think it's that important.
That's right. That's right.
You get enough people out there telling them that it is important, and they'll bloody well do something about it.
Mm. Either that or vote them out. Anyway. Moving on, because we can yell about that for an entire episode. Speaking of winning battles and so on and so forth, Led Zeppelin finally won the court battle over Stairway.
Finally.
Yeah. I mean, the US Supreme Court actually denied to hear the case.
Well, the US Supreme Court have got bigger problems to worry about at the moment. I mean, maybe if Donald Trump was no Led Zeppelin fan, then maybe they'd do a Supreme Court hearing over it. But the case was just bullshit anyway. I can't understand, like, ooh, you know, the chord changes over a descending bass line. Everyone's been doing that all the way since bloody Mozart and Beethoven.
Yeah.
I don't understand how they thought that was, like, the thing.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately right now I have the image of Donald Trump being a Led Zeppelin fan in my head. And that's just frightening. You know, I'm not quite sure which one he would dress up as, though it's probably Robert Plant. And the idea of him in bell bottoms and a really low cut grandpa shirt frightens me.
No. There's nothing like that at all. He just likes the lyrics of Stairway to Heaven. It's basically his entire life, isn't it?
All the
glitters is gold, buys the Stairway to Heaven.
Mm, yeah, it's probably not wrong. Oh, God. Man. Anyway, congratulations to the boys from Led Zeppelin for finally beating that and restoring the wonder that is Stairway to Heaven. Maybe we'll see it back on YouTube now. That'd be nice.
Nah, I wouldn't put a bet on it.
Mm. Additionally, as well, Unify Festival, which for people not in Australia, Unify is a big metal festival that happens normally once a year in Australia. They've actually released a statement saying they're in a holding pattern over the next installment of the festival. The issue isn't so much that they don't know who's going to play, but they don't know when they're going to be able to hold it. Apparently about 90% of the lineup is locked in, which would tell me they're probably waiting on maybe a headliner. But it's good to know that it's less of a case of if, and it's more of a case of when.
Maybe they're waiting for an international, to see if they can get an international headliner into the country, potentially.
I would say that's probably what they're waiting on, and then that will probably dictate the win. If it were me, that's probably what
yeah, you need that big draw card to get in, to get them in.
Absolutely. So now, of course, we can start speculating as to who might actually be headlining it, and that will come in very, very soon, I'm guessing. And, Hoggy,
I guess it depends on what sort of festival they're trying to go for. Is it, like, sort of big and popular, or are they going for, like, a more of a harder sort of alternative, not even necessarily alternative metal, but, like, just a bit more of a left field kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably bigger, popular kind of thing. Unify seems to be more that, you know, your Polaris, your North Lane, Parkway
Drive.
When
I hear bigger and popular metal thing, I immediately think of like Metallica or Megadeth or similar.
Oh, okay. You know, no, I think it's
one of those
that
big name headliners.
Right. Well, I mean, that'd be really interesting, you know.
I don't think you'd get them to be able to do it, because you'd literally need to bring in a couple of hundred people into the country and then have them all self-isolate from wherever in America they're coming from.
Yeah, true.
It'd be a logistical fucking nightmare.
It would be a clusterfuck. Especially for like a 1 day or 2 day festival.
Bring them in for 2 weeks, put them up in an entire hotel somewhere, and then
I mean, it could be someone
probably,
like
probably
Periphery.
Possibly.
You know?
Same problem though, just slightly less people.
Well, way less people. There's only five of them, plus their tour guy, plus a couple of stage techs and things. And realistically they back pocket tour anyway, backpack tour, so it's not really a big deal with them. It's not like, you know, Dream Theater and Metallica, where you've got truckloads of shit. being dragged in. Anyway, speaking of tours, you've got something in here about an amazing tour happening that unfortunately is now sold out.
Hey, well, the two shows here in Perth that Carnival are going to be playing have been completely sold out, one in Fremantle and then one in Inglewood here in Perth. Mm-hmm. Both of those have been sold out, but they are playing some shows in regional cities, and I'm just going to pull up now those where they're going to be.
Not I know one of them is in Broome. I know it's Port Hedland.
Yeah, I know. The Port Hedland one is happening while I'm at home, which is really fucking annoying. It's the, it's the closest fucking city I work to, so I could have done it. Right, here we go. Yep, okay. Yeah, so those two are sold out. The rest of them are still open. Ooh, the one in Kalgoorlie is still open. Yeah, but that's for race weekend. Nah, fuck that. All right, so... Yeah, so there's a series of shows happening over the course of 10 days at the end of this month. The 21st of October in Geraldton, 22nd of October in Exmouth, 24th of October in Port Hedland, 25th of October in Broome, the 28th of October in Kalgoorlie, and then the two shows here in Perth on the 30th and 31st of Perth, 31st of October, both of which are now sold out. Both of those shows sold out, incidentally, in about half an hour. And this is separate, by the way, to the National Sound Awake Tour that's still happening next year. That's happening March next year. So that's still happening. I know there were some comments online from people saying, oh, but I've got tickets for your other show. Can I get tickets to this one? No. Different people, different company, different tour. Well, that one's already been rescheduled. You can't get tickets for that one.
I mean, the answer is yes, you can. What you do is you take money and you exchange money for goods and services.
Yes, exactly. You take your money and you exchange money for a ticket. But I think people were hoping that there was going to be this movie rescheduled thing. But no, this is a completely different tour. My problem with this tour is that they're playing two shows at two very small clubs. Now, long-time listeners of this show will have heard me yell about this before, but when Carnival play in Perth, they always play really small clubs. At least they're not playing the Rosemount Hotel anymore, so thank God for that. But they are playing Freo Social and a place called Milk Bar, which are both relatively small clubs, maybe a couple of hundred people max.
Yeah.
Now, I figure if you sell out two shows inside an hour, that probably tells you could probably play somewhere slightly bigger.
Yes. But yes, I understand what you're saying.
I'm not saying they could play the Perth Arena and sell that out, but they could at least play somewhere like, I don't know, the Astor Theatre, for example, and sell that out.
Yeah,
it's not like
probably.
The Astor Theatre's got any shows going on at the moment, so they probably could play there.
Probably. I mean, you might find that, and we've had experience with this, Hoggy, you might find that the Astor Theatre might be one of those venues where the people running it are just notoriously difficult to deal with.
Potentially.
Maybe. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm not saying that it is the case because I don't know. But, you know, speculating, that might be the case.
Possibly.
You know, it very well may also be that they just don't pick up the phone or, you know, they've got a particular deal with whomsoever it is that's doing the ticketing that they run with these particular venues. The other thing as well to think of is that if they do a tour and it's completely sold out, it looks better on paper. It doesn't matter that the capacity is only 50 people. You've still sold out an entire tour.
True.
You know, and that looks much better from a marketing perspective as well. So that could be
actually, it's something else that I've just thought of. Here in Western Australia, we still have like venue capacity restrictions. It's not completely open season here in Western Australia, despite opinions to the contrary. Mm-hmm. So maybe those slightly bigger venues, okay, it still costs X dollars to hire out that venue, but you can only sell then a certain number of tickets.
Number of tickets
sold does not equal number of tickets sold does not equal venue cost.
That could be the case.
Whereas the smaller places, you can hire them out for less money, still sell less tickets at a reasonable price point and still make money.
Yes.
Because I guarantee you that these two Perth shows are probably what's bootstrapping the rest of the other five.
More than likely.
Maybe the one in Kalgoorlie might sell out, maybe, but the other four? Nah, I wouldn't have thought so.
I thought they would have had a fair chance at Broome because they play in the Pearl Luggers or is it the Rowey they're playing?
No, they're playing the Roebuck Hotel.
Okay, yeah, Rowey's small. Like, it's large-ish, but it's small. So, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me because you probably have quite a few people coming from further afield, you know what I mean? But Broome is a small town. So, you know, and it's not like they're getting up there in peak season. So who knows? I mean, I personally would love to fly over for that, to see one of my favorite bands in my favorite town in the world. Yeah, I would pay good money for that.
Yeah, good luck though. Yeah. You'd have to fly over here now.
Well, no, because I wouldn't be able to get across the border without a border pass.
No, you wouldn't be able to get across the border. Then you'd have to isolate for 2 weeks. Yeah. Then you could go up to Broome and do it.
Exactly. So anyway, long story. We've got a really interesting situation here at the moment with Western Australia and the rest of Australia, folks. For those of you who are not playing from Australia, it's really interesting. There's new calls for Western Australia to like secede from the rest of it and become its own country.
Piss off. No.
I'm serious. There are these new things coming out.
Look, it's ridiculous. I saw the survey. They surveyed like 3,500 people. It was all people over the age of 50, not politically aligned with a major party. It's the closest thing to like a crackpot survey you could come up with.
Excuse me, I believe the correct term is a Hansen survey.
Yeah, exactly. It's like short of ringing. You basically just run the telephone book on One Nation members in Western Australia and go, do you think we should secede from Western Australia? Yes, no. And then act shocked when they all say yes. Bullshit.
I still find it hilarious.
Do I, as a native-born Western Australian, think we should be seceding from the rest of Australia? Of course not.
I still find it hilarious. I still find it really funny.
It's very funny, but no. It's not. Yes.
But yeah.
The restrictions are in Australia at the moment. Western Australia, we're all, like, to a first approximation, back to normal. The only difference is that we have a hard border with the rest of Australia. We can't leave. They can't come in.
Yeah.
Unless you've got a damn good reason.
Yes.
Like, you're coming here for a job and or someone is dying.
Yes, basically. Yeah, so, you can't go over there for a holiday,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera.
So there's lots of pushing within Western Australia to get people to go to regional areas to go on holiday. Mm-hmm. Personally, it's not such a bad idea, but, you know, the accommodation prices to stay in some of these regional areas at the moment is astronomically high because everybody wants to go there and naturally they put the prices up.
Well, it's the same thing here.
I don't blame them.
So, yeah, so I think it's going to be a really, really good tour. You know, with Carnival, if you're lucky enough to get it, make sure you grab a ticket. And if you're in one of those remote regions, if you're in one of those remote regions where they're going through, please grab a ticket and go and see them because they're absolutely amazing live. Now, final bit of news for this fortnight. New Marillion book coming out, covering the 80s, apparently. Now, Hoggy, you're way more across Marillion than I am. What do you reckon is going to be in it?
What do I think is going to be in it? Well, there's probably... I mean, I don't think there's anything that's going to... I mean, first of all, I'd like to know if this book is, like, officially sanctioned by members of the band, like, whether or not they've actually granted them interviews for this book. I'd be very surprised if they have, frankly, because most of what I suspect is probably going to be in this book has either A, been hashed out in other books previously released, or any of the special edition CD, DVD, Blu-ray combos that EMI have been cranking out over the last couple of years of that... I mean, EMI had Marillion for the first 6 albums, which covers all of this period, and then the first 2 records that they, or the first 3 records they did with Steve Hogarth. So this book covers basically that era. So I'd be very surprised if there's anything in there that the diehard Marillion fans don't already know. Although, you know, I'm fairly certain the diehard Marillion fans know the backstory of Marillion better than members of the band do.
More than likely. It seems to be that way often with many
things. It's like Beatles fans. Like Paul McCartney openly acknowledged it. He's like, I can't remember when this happened. If you want to know what it was, ask a fan. They know it better than I do. So it's exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Nah, that's cool.
So yeah, am I going to buy a copy of this book? It comes out in a couple of days' time. Nah, I'm not going to bother.
Well, there you go. All right, we should move on some new music that has come out in the last little while. Hemina has released a new one called Neon. Hoggy, have you managed to take a listen to this?
I sure have. I really enjoyed it, actually. I mean, it does sound a bit sort of retro 80s kind of thing, especially with the saxophone, but there's definitely some modern twists to it. It's not a straight-up pastiche of, like, 80s pop music in any way, shape, or form. I particularly also enjoyed the 3-part vocal harmonies that were going on through some of the verses and most of the chorus as well. And then there's a really fantastic instrumental section at the back end of the song. I really enjoyed it. We'll throw a link in the show notes to their official YouTube channel where you can go and listen to the song. Go and check it out. It's really cool.
It is really good. Very, 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 very good and very, very them. Too. They seem to be doing sort of edging down this sort of road of late, and it's fucking fantastic. And frankly, I want to see more.
Totally.
The second one, another friend of the show, James Norwood Ivanyi, his brand new album is coming out very, very soon, but he has released the lead-off single off that, Rubik's Grand Convolution. Have you had a chance to listen to this one?
I sure haven't. My goodness, the man has got some guitar chops.
Yeah, just a couple.
We already knew, just a few. We already knew this, of course. This is his style. It's very much the sort of jazz fusion, progressive metal, mixing sort of, you know, John Petrucci, Steve Vai, other, you know, Animals as Leaders, you know, that sort of style of instrumental progressive metal. He's doing it really, really well. Sort of starts off a bit like video gamey sort of kind of thing, and then just ends in like, you know, ridiculously complicated passages of music and lots of like A and B sections mixing together. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, it is.
Again, we'll throw a link in the show notes to that. Go and check that one out. It's really cool.
It's awesome. It starts off like, for those of you video game fans there, it starts off a bit like Contra, and then goes basically into melt your face bullshit. It's just, it's ridiculous. So good. We will put a link in the show notes as Hoggy mentioned. And the third brand new track that's come out in the last little while, the brand new Stephen Wilson track.
Yeah, that's out now. Let's move on.
Yeah. So our main topic for this week is the brand new album and long-awaited album from Phish called Weltschmerz, which, as we've mentioned previously on the show, literally translates to world pain, or pain of the world, if you want to get really technical. My God, what an album.
Oh, yeah. Now, we spoke about this record. Well, we spoke about the lead-off EP for this record, which contains half the songs on this album, A Parley with Angels. Now, we spoke about this record, I think, something like a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
I've moved houses twice since we recorded that episode, so that tells you how long ago it was. So, well, we'll put a link in the show notes to that. We had a quick, short discussion about that. But this time around, we're going to go track by track on the full album. Now, as you mentioned, this one has been quite a long process. We'll jump in by talking about the first track, Grace of God. And given that the health problems that Phish has endured over the years, I mean, he almost died during the recording of this record. He had some rather serious health problems that sort of laid him up in a hospital for a while. So, I suspect that some of the lyrical parts that have been, and we're going to talk a lot about the lyrics in this record. Obviously, it's Phish. So there's lots of reflections on his own life and reflections with sort of, you know, that sort of thing. And I suspect that much of what happened in that part of his life influenced what happens in this song.
Absolutely. I mean, look, starting from the top, I mean, the intro is absolutely fantastic, and it is a great way to open the album. But you know, there's a lot of talk in the actual song about surgery, talk about, you know, cannulas and, you know, the beeping machines and so on and so forth, slipping in and out of consciousness, etc. I think it's quite obvious that you're talking about hospital and hospital stays and hospital visits and so on and so forth in that.
Surprisingly prophetic given this COVID situation, even though this lyric has been around for well before this COVID situation.
What's this up to now? Like 8 or 9 prophetic prog albums this year?
Something like that, yeah. Something like that. I mean, the middle section with the acoustic guitars and about the young girl with the cotton dress, like, you know, I've been there in my life, you know, in hospital with dying relatives, and the kids are all dressed up but don't really know what's going on. I mean, that imagery and the way that lyric sort of portrays that, it does a brilliant job. And again, this is something I'm going to be saying quite a bit during this record. Brilliant job of like putting imagery into using words to paint a picture, and the imagery of that to create a sort of this vision of what's going on.
Absolutely.
This is the strength of Phish, and has been for years.
Oh yeah.
In another age, he'd have been like a poet or a screenwriter or something. Yeah. But yet here he is like a rock musician and a damn fine lyricist.
Oh, absolutely. What's really interesting as well is there's a couple of little lyrics in there. For example, there's one talking about you know, coffin nails, and a coffin nail is also known as a cigarette. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it could very well be about people with lung cancer and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I don't think it is. It's probably, you know, about his personal experiences and things. But it could be quite easily translated across to anyone who's had any hospital experience. But with that one little line, you could make it very, very quite a poignant post and talk about the plight of smoking on society, particularly in Australia, where, you know, smoking is just a heinous and disgusting thing that's very, very rare to see this these days.
Unless you work in the mining industry, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, mining industry or building sites, I suppose. But if you're in the city, yeah, you know, once upon a time, every, you know, 9 out of 10 people would have smoked.
I wonder actually whether or not this COVID situation has inspired a whole bunch of people to give up smoking.
Yeah, I wonder so. I mean, he's got a whole verse in there as well about smoking, doesn't he? About walking outside and seeing people smoking.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that's the lead-off track. And so I think that gives a pretty good understanding of what we're going to get out of this record. We're getting a lot of poetic, deep imagery backed. And the music is very much in service of the lyrics.
Mm.
I mean, the work that Fish and Steve Vance did to put together this song and all of the songs on this record, the music is very much in service of the lyrics.
Mm.
Because let's be clear here, we're all here for this Fish song, to immerse ourselves in the lyrics here.
Mm, 100%.
We're not necessarily here for some, you know, flashy, amazing musicianship, although there is a bit of that around as well. The very well-crafted songwriting is what you're getting here.
I mean, you talk about there being very well-crafted songwriting and so on and so forth, and if it weren't for the lyrics for the next song, Man With a Stick, I mean, I wasn't a really big fan of it. It was interesting, particularly texturally. There were quite some interesting sounds and such going on in the background, but otherwise it was a bit 80s. You know, that synth solo is lifted straight from every single pop song from the early 80s. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
it does seem rather Phil Collins era Genesis sounding to me.
Thank you. Yes, I was trying to figure it out. I'm like, I'm sure
Fish will love that comparison, by the way, having spent most of his early career being compared to Genesis and being compared to Peter Gabriel, and here he is at the end of his career being compared to Phil Collins. I'm sure he'll love that.
Predictable. Yeah. So, you know.
Exactly. I mean, lyrically, it's probably about a man from a bygone era who could be a school teacher or a headmaster or a police officer. You know, there's references to stuff with, like, picket lines and the verse, you know, you gave them your all, got a watch and a bungalow, mothballed the uniform and faded away.
Mm.
So it could easily be like a police officer who's used, you know, corporal punishment to keep things in line. But now in this modern era, that's not seen as very acceptable. So now he's sort of, like, got to take that sort of mentality to some other new place.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I mean, it definitely does seem to be, I mean, the man with a stick, I mean, headmaster, you know, whipping people. I mean, my dad tells me stories about, you know, getting the cane when he was a kid,
an old English bobby with a truncheon, and, you know, because they didn't give them guns back then. They gave them, like, truncheons or nightsticks or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, could as very easily be that too.
Absolutely. But still a good song, and lyrically still very, very, very good. You know, very, very, very well written to be expected.
So we'll move on to the next track, Walking on Eggshells. Mm. And again, you know, this is another example of Fish painting a brilliant picture of a situation of a broken relationship.
Mm.
You know, again, music in service of the lyric. Some very powerful imagery going on in this lyric as well. You know, this is the whole verse here, which I'm going to read out. You know, vitriolic barrage, the endless stream of characters, the blame game, the shaming, the acidic accusations. All they have are shattered doors, mirrors smashed, the images retained in an unbroken circle.
Mm.
You know, it's just I'm no lyricist, and I know you're not particularly see yourself as a lyricist either, Dave. You got to give it up. I mean, that is some very powerful imagery right there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, the song itself, there's one particular line that hit me, which was a perspective of his life suffering inside. That really hit me quite hard. You know, it's an incredible example of Fish's writing ability. You know, and this song really started to hit me, and me not being the biggest Marillion fan, it's not like I've listened to every single one of their albums 95 times and could tell you all the trivia and all that sort of stuff. I know them, but, you know, they're not my favorite thing ever. But it's quite obvious that Fish has his own sound as well. I mean, the middle eight,
and that sound is, and also that sound has definitely developed from the early days of Marillion as well.
Yes,
he last wrote an album with Marillion in 1987, so we're talking about quite some time ago, and there's definitely been a progression through some Admittedly, I'm not the closest follower of Fish's solo career. There's a couple of like his recent album, Feast of Consequences, was really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
I also particularly enjoyed Sunsets on Empire. There's a few other records in the middle there as well, which I'm not particularly familiar with, but you know, he's really brought some fantastic lyrics to this record, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, there's, I don't know, there's just great lyrics through the whole track. You know, despite her bleak misgivings, all his feelings still remain. The door is always open, a bed is always there, a roof to fly above her, a harbor for her fears. You know, just very, very dense, and obviously not unhappy to shy away from those particular feelings and so on and so forth, and to write a lot of that in there as well. And I mean, that particular sound as well, you know. For starters, the opening of the song was really, really cool. I thought it was just a really, really interesting sort of use of panning of instruments and so on and so forth. But then you had that middle eight section. We've got that acoustic guitar thing that he seems to like to do. You know, very, very good, very solid song. Can't complain about it.
No, not at all. So we move on to the next song, The Party's Over.
Yes.
Now, this one I think has definitely got a lot more anger behind it. The other
absolutely.
Ones are sort of more of plaintive and sort of reflective and trying to really build a set. But this one's really out in front, banging hands on the table, saying this is a shit situation. I mean, this is one of the verses here, which I'm going to read out here. It's like, running out of options, no more excuses. Approaching midnight, the clock ticks down. What do I say? What do we tell the children? Ring out the changes while we still have time.
Yeah.
Now, I did a bit of reading around this lyric, and this is a lyric that's been around for quite some time. You know, Fisher's had this lyric for a while about sort of the climate crisis, the climate change. You know, what are we going to do when we run out of the oil sort of situation? And everyone in power doesn't really seem to give a shit. They just hand out more money to the coal and gas lobbies and continue on their merry way like everything's fine.
Yeah.
But everybody else is sort of screaming at them. It's like, well, no, we need change now. This is not a tomorrow problem. This isn't like something we can just kick down the line to someone else. We have to do something about it now.
Absolutely. And the theme for this particular song comes back again later. Toward the end of the album. I do want to say three things about this particular song, though. You know, Irish pan flute, strummed guitar, and a sax solo. Those are three things that make me very happy, and I realized it when I was listening to this song. Although I hate faded outros, it's like fade outs, I can't fucking stand them. The lyrics are a little bit more straight up, I think, than some of the others that are here, but it's a fantastic track. And honestly, I think if you were going to introduce someone to Fish, I think this would be one of those tracks that you would give them and go, hey, listen to this, what do you think?
Yeah, fair enough. But you, like you say, all the lyrics are a little aren't as deep. It's like, well, when you're dealing with a subject like this, I don't think you can sort of, you know, use flowery imagery and sort of deep connective verses. You've really got to stand out there and bang your hands on the table over this one.
Yes, I agree with you. Agreed. I do like the imagery that he gives us in the second stanza, though. It's an ugly crowd. I don't belong here. Beautiful people checked out long ago. Sad to say I decline your invitation. My best regards, but it's time to go. I really, really like that idea. It's like, you know what, I came here with good intentions, with a good crowd of people and all that sort of stuff, but they're long gone, so why am I still here? Yeah, you know, I love that idea and that notion. It's just absolutely fantastic.
I wonder whether that's like a subtle jab towards, oh, no, see, this lyric predates Brexit, so it can't be about Brexit. This lyric well and truly predates Brexit.
Yeah,
so.
But I'm sure it doesn't predate xenophobia. I'm sure it doesn't.
Absolutely.
Of that stuff. And realistically, that's what Brexit was. It was xenophobia on a national scale.
Yes, you can come and at us over that one if you really must.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will defend that position for as long as I can get away with it.
Bloody oath.
You know, Brexit was just all about xenophobia and getting rid of immigrants.
And Murdoch flexing his muscles.
And tax dodging as well. There was definitely a fair amount of that going on.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Anyway, we move along to the next song on the album, Rose of Damascus. What did you think about this one, Dave?
This one was really interesting because I started listening to it and I was like, oh, that's a weird time signature. And then I realized it was just a really interesting take on 4-4. So, you know, it's simple common time, but the flow of the lyrics and the interchange between the two sort of intro strumming patterns and guitar patterns is really, really, really cool. You know, I was unsure if this was going to be a big guitar track and I wanted it to be really badly, but it sort of didn't wind up being like a big, big guitar track or anything like that. And that sort of is pretty much the entirety of this album. There's not a lot of like big, big guitar moments or anything on there. But I am going to make the comparison here at this particular track now. And I'm sorry for doing this, but I can totally see where Stephen Wilson gets his shit from now.
Well, Stephen Wilson and Fish worked on some records together back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, but, you know, if you go and listen to a lot of the Porcupine Tree stuff, you can hear where a lot of that influence has clearly come from.
Oh, totally.
You know what I mean?
Fish's influences on Stephen Wilson are relatively apparent, except Fish is a far, far better lyricist.
Oh, yes.
And Stephen Wilson's latest offerings lead me to like roll my eyes with how stupidly direct they are.
Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, we get it, Stephen. You're tired of Facebook. Woo-hoo.
It's
a hot take there, buddy.
It's really interesting when you look at this particular stuff and you start thinking about what Porcupine Tree could have been with Fish's lyrics. You know, I mean, I would have loved to have heard like an In Absentia kind of era take on this particular song, because for me, 15 minutes of this particular song got a bit boring.
I know what you mean.
You know,
it
just dragged
its
feet a little bit, whereas if it had some of that, you know, crazy fucking Gavin Harrison drumming behind it with some, you know, bit driven guitars and things like that, it was a little bit sort of meatier. I think it could have been an absolute slayer of a song, but it kind of just dragged its feet a bit.
Potentially, but the other part of it as well is like, I think what he was going for is that the absence of a guitar trying to develop a sort of a mood there, where I think the guitars in there might have moved a little bit too. A little bit too obvious, perhaps, or a little bit too much straight ahead if you just kind of put a big guitar sort of thing in there. I don't know.
Yeah, it could have been. I mean, I'm not...
That sort of brooding disquiet as he tells the story of a young girl in Syria who's had her world shattered by war and power struggles and all that stuff. Mm. I mean, this is a theme Fish has gone over a couple of times in his lyrics. I mean, drawing on his experiences, he went to Bosnia in the 90s to, you know, help out with the... He did a performance over there in Bosnia. Mm. So he's been in and around those sort of like war zones and that sort of thing. So I imagine... He's definitely speaking from a place of knowledge here about, you know, lives shattered in the futility of war.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I mean, it could be one of a whole bunch of different things. I'm just saying that that's probably how I would have approached it. You know, I'm not necessarily saying that he's wrong or anything like that. I mean, the guy's been around a while. He knows his shit. I'm
Absolutely.
Just saying it would have been nice to hear a little bit more of that, you know. 15 minutes effort was just a touch long for this particular track. Great track, just a bit long.
Fair enough. Okay, so we move on to Garden of Remembrance. What do you think of this one, Dave?
Yeah, so this is the one we touched on a little while ago. This was that the sort of, I don't want to call it the single, but, you know, the single.
Sort of,
You know, it was about dementia and Alzheimer's and, you know, fantastically done. Interestingly, I could see DT doing a cover of this. You know, sort of something like a little bit more like, you know, one of those sort of piano and singing moments.
Yeah.
Lyrically, it's just phenomenal. Very,
yeah. Of all the lyrics on this record, this one touched me the most. I mean, personally, I have a very deep and long family history of people with dementia, people with Alzheimer's disease, and I related to this song so much. Never before have I ever heard anyone capture the essence of being a family member of someone with late-stage dementia so well. I'm sure if I ever saw this song live, I'd probably become a blubbering wreck.
Mm.
It was very, I could sit here and quote so many of those things just reminded me of my grandfather or my grandmother or my great grandmother, you know, all these people who towards the end stages of their lives, you know, they've had, you know, successful and productive lives. And then you just watch them just slowly just sort of whittle away as the dementia takes hold and just robs them of everything.
Mm.
And when I say everything, I mean absolutely everything. You'd be surprised what they forget how to do or forget who, you know, the sort of blank stare when you look at someone you've been married to, and like you just look at someone you've been married to for 60 some odd years at this point. It's just, yeah, you know.
The bit that got me was in the very first stanza. He tries to remember just what made him cry with the beautiful stranger who was holding his hand.
Yeah.
That got me. I just went,
yep.
Yeah, okay, cool. Well done.
Yeah.
You can't.
He could not have nailed that any better.
Absolutely.
I am guessing, although I don't know specifically, that he's probably had a similar sort of experience with a family member of his own, I'm guessing.
I would say so. I mean, I wouldn't put it past him to be able to write something like this without having that experience, but the way the lyrics are written seem to me that he has had that personal experience.
Possibly. I don't know. And yeah.
We've just spent like 30 minutes telling everyone about how what a great lyricist he is and what an amazing storyteller and such. So I'm not going to put it past him that maybe he's just done it because he's amazing.
Absolutely.
But I think the lyrics and the way that they're written tell me that he's probably had that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, let's move on to Trondheim Waltz. What do you think?
It's an interesting one. I'm guessing this is sort of like Fischer's ode to being a touring musician. You know, the need to live up. I mean, he has had some tours there where he's had problems with his voice on tour and or just problems with the tour itself where it's not going very well. He's losing money, And so, but he still has to live up to his reputation as a live performer and do a good show for the people that have turned up and paid their money. But there's all these other problems going on in the background. Money problems, health problems, problems at home, problems with the record label, problems. But you've still got to, you know, turn up and do a good job and still perform. As a musician. So I'm guessing that in the imagery of doing that in somewhere like Trondheim, you know, a city in Norway, I think there's an interesting sort of backdrop to that, I think.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I thought the intro of it was a bit interesting because Trondheim, obviously a city in Norway, very famous for cathedrals and things like that and medievalness and as European cities are. It made the first line about Peruvian coffee a little odd. Adobe and Peruvian coffee or whatever it was.
Yeah, but I'm guessing like Norway per capita is one of the countries in the world that drinks the most amount of coffee. So I'm guessing it's not too hard to find a particular fussy brand of coffee in Norway.
Yeah, in one of
the independent little coffee shops,
that's,
I'm guessing.
That's possible. I mean, I don't know if there's some special significance to fish there, maybe. Maybe a specific coffee house that he really liked that had that.
Possibly.
You know, it could be. You know, the begonias melt in the sun. I thought that was really good. You know, begonias are a particular type of plant, with a little, flower and such that are quite interesting. And then the next part, listening to a song about a mysterious whisterer from the voice of a good man long gone. Now, I would love to know who that good man long gone is.
Well, there's probably a way to find out. I mean, Fish is still doing his Friday live streams. You know, he's Fish on Friday on Facebook. Mm. So if we are interested, we could always just jump on there and ask him.
Yeah, I mean, hey.
And if anyone else is actually interested, I mean, he played good portions of this record during those Friday live streams. They're all on his Facebook. And for a while as well, he was updating a podcast. So it was a podcast as well.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend watching the video live streams over the podcast. There are some things that are kind of missed when you're listening to it only as an audio thing.
Mm.
So if you're looking for something to do or something to listen to and, you know, this is of your interest, good couple of hours of Fish answering questions from diehard fans of his work and such forth for several hours every Friday for the last couple of months.
But yeah, it is really interesting. And the thing is, obviously, I don't know whether or not he's actually in a cafe or if he's in a house, because then it says the monitor screen, a black window. I'm ignoring the knock at the door, an unopened letter on the table before me, an unanswered call on the phone. So I think maybe he's got like a little like an Airbnb or something like that, you know, that he's maybe he's got an apartment there. Who knows?
Possibly.
But, you know,
Or it's all just like extrapolating on the situation. Like, yes, some of it's based in truth, but then there's a little sort of extrapolations and tasty embellishments for the purposes of the story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I think it's great. I think it's a great track. Very well written, obviously. Great picture painter. You know, Fish is just an amazing picture painter. So it's fantastic.
So we move on to Little Man What Now. What did you think of this one, Dave?
Oh, man, that opening. The 90s called, they want their 808 back. And for the first time, my God, there's an electric guitar. Not for the first time, but, you know, it's quite obvious. It honestly sounds a little bit like a forgotten track from Blade Runner. It's got that, you know, sort of strange, what's the term? Like that sort of sci-fi-ish, weird kind of offbeat vibe to it, which I actually really like. There's an amazing lyric in it, though. The words deserve to be spoken when his tongue was tied. And what hit me was there's a particular song by a country artist, Alan Jackson, who I've mentioned a couple of times on the show. And he does a song called The Little Man. And it's about a guy who was in a small town and grew up as the little man. He was the guy that would help, you know, help you change your flat on a rainy night and, you know, used to help you pump your gas and all that kind of stuff. And then big business moved in and basically put him out of business. The lyrics of that particular song go, now the court square's just a city street and people go around, but they seldom think about the little man that built this town before the big money came and shut him down. And that's what I get from this particular song. Is the idea that, you know, it's about a little man up against big companies and such, who's been silenced basically because he can't get his voice up because he's just not big enough to get his voice up amongst, you know, the chattering of larger corporations and larger voices and such. That being said, the track is a little meandering at times, but it's still brilliantly written. What did you think?
I mean, you're right. It does sound something like from a Massive Attack or maybe like a Seal record, perhaps. I don't know. I didn't know that country song, actually. You may very well be right. There may be some sort of ode to that, you know, lyrically from that song. I don't know. But it might not even be that far removed from, I mean, he's been fighting the system as an independent musician for decades. Mm-hmm. You know, all the fighting, you know, these years, you know, fighting, you know, the system and trying to get his music out there, mm-hmm. you know, outside of the EMI record machine sort of thing. And now he's at the end of his career. It's like, well, what was all that for? What now?
Mm.
You know, there's a lyric here, you know, and eloquently mumble as the ignorant shout them down, backed into a corner, humbled by the might of greed and market forces of the privileged who sight, well, little man, what now?
Mm.
You may very well be right. It may just be a sort of a lyrical ode to that country song by Alan Jackson there. It's very interesting.
It could just be a particular, I mean, it's just, you know, Little Man is kind of pretty standard kind of thing, you know. But I mean, it just reminded me of it straight away and the second that I heard it, and I was like, okay, cool. But I love that idea of, well, little man, what now? You know, I think it's such a, it's almost a warning, you know, with these massive, massive companies that are basically taking over everything.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, second to last track, The Waverley Steps. What did you think of this one?
This one is another very acoustically driven. I suspect all these acoustic songs were developed during Fish's highly successful acoustic tour he did before his last record, A Feast of Consequences. And now they've been sort of, now he's come back to those sort of things and worked up to put on this record. I mean, this is another example of how little you need musically to paint a picture, create a mood, and develop this sense of hopelessness, vagueness, and a sense of like no future. The lyrics are obviously about, you know, a homeless man sort of searching for somewhere to stay. Mm. Someone who was probably once successful but now finds himself homeless. Mm. You know, how quickly those things can sort of turn on a dime and you end up suddenly on the street.
Yeah, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with you. It's a great showcase on how we can only be really one or two steps away from being homeless.
You know,
and it can be anything that throws us there. You know, I know people who who were, you know, investment bankers, and their wife got jack of them working all the time, so she left with the kids. Because of that, he started drinking, and because of that, he fell behind on mortgage repayments. They repossessed his house. Now he lives on the street. Yeah, I know people. Wow. I know people like that.
Yeah.
And it's really, really heartbreaking. You know, the lyrics here really, really, really shine because, you know, it starts off sort of, you know, just sort of like sounding like someone commuting from an office, right? You know, back of a train, he stares out a window, the carriage is empty, commuting is done. It's the end of the line, right? And you're like, okay, maybe it's some guy's like getting off at the end, you know, and he's sort of looking out. It sort of starts off like as if it's someone looking out about being sort of unhappy about how the city has turned out. You know, he's grown up in a time when, you know, there were rolling fields and all that sort of stuff, and now there's just, you know, paved paradise, put up a parking lot kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then slowly you kind of realize that, no, it's actually about a homeless guy. You know, at the end of it, it's, you know, from the Waverley steps, he stares at the station tied to the black dog faithful beside him at the end of the line. Black dog, I think, mind you, being depression.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fairly obvious metaphor for depression.
It's
there.
Quite a pretty, yeah. pretty obvious one. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he hid his heart alone in darkness and fought back the tears from his eyes, the weight of the world, the heaviest burden. Out of dreams are born everything. Out of hope comes the light. He woke up to the vision, chased the dog to the night. That's yep. really powerful.
That is absolutely.
You know, and it's just, yeah, I wonder what the genesis of this song was. You know, I have to wonder whether or not he was at, I don't know if there is a Waverley Steps somewhere, and he saw, you know, the homeless guy there literally catching the coins from weary commuters, and wondered what that person was actually thinking.
Real-time follow-up here. Waverley Steps is a stand link to a unit it's kind of a linking two parts of Edinburgh.
Oh, okay, there you go.
So, yeah.
So, you know, I have to wonder whether or not maybe this was born out of something that he actually saw.
Potentially, yeah.
You know.
So now we move on to the final song on this record, the aforementioned title track, Weltschmerz. Mm. What did you think of this one, Dave?
So
tell me I said that right.
You did. We finally
thumbs up
get
from the,
to
thumbs
hear-
up from the audience behind me as well.
We finally get to hear a track where it's basically a me and I. I know we kind of heard a little bit earlier with the one about the party's over and so on and so forth, but this one really hit the nail on the head. You know, it really spoke to me with everything going on currently. Also, there's a guitar solo in it, which is just it scratched the itch, which was nice. But this particular line, my anger and fury trapped like a wasp in a jar.
Yeah.
That line got me and I went, okay, cool. Finally, at least one boomer out there is listening. you know, I love that because it's this idea of, I imagine a wasp in a jar sort of, I imagine one of those, you know, that like the Makona coffee jars, you know, with like the plunger top thing. But I imagine like the big fuck off ones that you buy for the office that someone always steals and takes home because we can't have nice things. Thanks, Karen. And I imagine the wasp being in there and, you know, it being sort of on a shelf somewhere. And then I imagine, you know, it's trapped and you'd be thinking of the fucking fury, how furious that wasp is. And you'd be standing there looking at the wasp going, I know that that thing there is very dangerous, but it's in a jar and it can't hurt me. But then one morning you wake up and the wasp isn't there anymore. You know what I mean? And that's the part that really gets me thinking about it. You know, these people almost that keep something extremely dangerous in a glass jar where they can watch it, but they never really, they don't have to deal with it. They don't have to deal with the consequences. They don't have to deal with the ramifications of, in this particular case, the fury and the anger.
Sounds like a commentary on classism, doesn't it? You know, the rich people sort of look down at, oh, God, look at all the squabbling masses below me. They don't really have to get involved with it at all, do they?
No, it's exactly right. You know, it's just, I mean, it's just an incredible analogy for it, you know. And then you've got the bits right at the end. You know, the shells of the cathedrals, the yellowing grass, the plum dark tornadoes, fluttering flags, the queues at the food banks, the raging typhoons, the gangs on the corner, the shadows that groom, the flating of the dahlias, the forests of fire, the walls in the desert, the rapture is near.
Yeah, sort of like, again, I'm sure he's going to love this comparison, but it's sort of almost like the opening to Merlion's Fear, where he's talking about the storm approaching. It's kind of like that. I mean, as I've said for a while, I always think that this record is sort of like the third part to a wacky trilogy between like Merlion's Fear, Roger Waters' Is This the Life We Want, and this is the third part. This, I mean, the first one was like the sense of foreboding. The second one was just basically pure anger mixed with this sort of tingeness of sadness. But this is more a mix of anger and resignation at the monumental shit show the world has become.
Yeah.
I do like that guitar solo, though. I think that feels like a big release at the end of an album, creating mood, tension, and emotion. And it's all just sort of released in this big solo at the end.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree
with
you.
Not at the end, but near the end.
It's phenomenal, and it really caps off an amazing album of really poetry set to music.
And an amazing career too. I mean, Fish has been on record that this is going to be his final record. Mm. He ain't doing any more music after this one. So I think this is a fantastic capper on a fantastic career as a musician, as a lyricist, as a singer. You know, he's nailed it with this one. I mean, and it's great to go out with a really, really great record. Many musicians have kind of sort of whimpered with some crap records towards the end there, but this one is fantastic. It's an excellent record.
Worth the wait, definitely.
Absolutely. I'm still waiting for my copy to turn up. It's on its way here now. But I urge everybody out there, go out and buy a copy of this record. It's really, really good. And you'll be supporting an independent musician. One thing we didn't mention at the top of this show, Fish said that if any of the sales that he'd made were, quote, chart eligible, he would have had a number two record this week with this album.
Yeah, that's right.
A number two record for an independent musician right at the very end of his career. And if that doesn't tell you how, like, weak and bullshit chart sales are, then fuck me, I don't know what does.
Yeah, I know. But look, I think...
What about you, Dave? What's your summary of this record?
I think overall it is... I'm not going to say it's one of the most original albums I've heard musically. I've heard a lot of this stuff before, although arguably this is probably the guy that's originated a lot of that stuff, and it's since bled through into other stuff that I've listened to and enjoyed, and now I'm sort of listening to the original sort of in a weird way, kind of like watching Home Alone 2 and then watching Home Alone 1. for want to use a better analogy. But it doesn't stop it being a phenomenal album. And it's almost a protest album.
Almost,
without being, you know, without being Fortunate Son flying over the battlefields of Vietnam. It's extremely well written, and there are lyrics in here which I guarantee you could give this album to anyone and they would find something in it that they would enjoy, whether that be musically or whether it be more probably lyrically. Weltschmerz is probably one of the best albums of this year, and by a fair way, I would think. Lyrically, it's incredible. And it hasn't quite so come out of the blue, but it's come out of the blue for me, not being a massive Marillion fan. I mean, two thumbs up. Go and listen to it. Go and buy it. Go and support this guy. Even though this is the last one, he deserves all the praise he can get.
Absolutely. So that brings to the end of the main topic of this week's show. So let's jump into album reviews. Now, the record that I gave you last time around was Ulver's Flowers of Evil. What did you think of this record?
I fucking loved it. It was this synthwave proggy shit, and it was just fun. It was a really fun album to listen to. It was great to put on both in the background when you got like dinner, or you're cooking dinner, or you've got a dinner on or something like that. Or it's really good to put headphones on and listen to while you're doing some gaming or something like that as well. It's a really good all-purpose album, which is very rare to say these days.
Absolutely.
And it's also just a great album. I just really, really enjoyed it. So definite recommendation from me for this one. And it came out this year, which was... Really good to see.
This is only a couple of months old, yeah. My sort of short version review of this album would be like, what if David Bowie fronted Depeche Mode?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, there's definitely some bit of vibes of that going on there.
Definitely.
But it's not a complete sort of pastiche of that. There's definitely some modern production and modern sort of things going on in that record. So, yeah. No. I hoped you might have liked the record, and I'm very happy to hear that you did.
I did. I very, very much enjoyed it. I've actually given it a couple of listens since listening to it initially. So, and that's reasonably rare with the amount of new music that I'm listening to at the moment, which, by the way, we're up to 291 hours of new prog albums this year.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Now, I gave you an album called Sonic Birth by the Progressive Souls Collective. What did you think of this one?
Now, I just put this record on and just started listening to it, and I'm like, oh, this sort of sounds a bit like Derek Sherinian. And I looked up and oh yeah, it is Derek Sherinian. It's like you can hear that organ sound is so him, it's not even funny.
Yep.
And then I was sort of clicking around looking at like, well, who else is in this band? And then you've got like Dr. Kevin Moore, mm-hmm. with doing some like loops and programming. I call him Doctor because he's actually an MD now.
Mm-hmm.
He's an actual honest to God medical doctor now.
Yeah. Which
and
is
then
awesome.
Back to, you know, you got the rhythm section of Aquilus Priester and Connor Green from Haken. Mm-hmm. So this guy's managed to assemble a superstar musician lineup for this record. And then the chap doing the vocals, Serbian chap for like Vladimir,
mm-hmm.
does a really good job. I'm going to have to go and check out his main band, the Serbian progressive metal band Organized Chaos. Mm. I'm going to have to go check that out.
They're good.
I quite liked his voice. I thought it was really good. Very different. Not sort of, you know, death growls and not any of the real high stuff. It's something of a different kind of place. It's very interesting.
So I
give this record a big thumbs up. Go and check it out.
Yeah, definitely worthwhile checking out. It's a cool album. It's a very, very, very cool album. All right, what do you got for me this week? Or Fortnite, I should say.
So for this time around for you, I'm going to give you a record by a Bulgarian band called Mental Architects. I'm going to give you their debut album from 2012 called Celebrations. Kind of listen to that and tell me what you think.
Excellent. I will do that. For you, I have a brand new album from a band called Methodica. The album is called Clockworks. It came out about a week ago. So you definitely want to check that one out.
These are the Italian guys?
Methodica?
Yep.
I think
cool.
So, yep.
Yep, Bandcamp. Yep, cool. It's on Bandcamp. Excellent, excellent. Finally, you've given me a record on Bandcamp. Fantastic. So that about wraps it up for this week on the 9-8 podcast. If you'd like to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the 9-8podcast.fireside.fm/63. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM. And feel free to jump over to our brand new Facebook page. We're going to be posting a few little links and clips to various things in between episodes. So you can find a link in the show notes to that Facebook page as well. Please give that a like and share it around with all of your music-loving friends. Mm. And also as well, please consider supporting us on Patreon. For a couple of bucks a month, you can get some after-show content, little things that didn't quite make the show here, or extra topics that don't quite fit the flow of the show, and early access to interviews that we are currently working on and have in the pipeline.
Absolutely, absolutely. As always, it's absolutely amazing to see you guys here, and thank you so much for supporting us. 3 years into this, it's oh so much fun. So once again, thank you so much for listening in. My name's Dave Ellis.
My name is Alex Hogg. Thank you very much. We'll see you all next time.